are getting a picture on the TV.
Yeah, go for it.
Welcome to the House of Strauss on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Stars hang with stars, winners hang with winners.
So we're good on the noise, we're good on the sound, everything's good. I feel like Reem and Ritter. Okay, you good? Okay, Andrew Bogut, we got a little reporter talking to you right now. He's going to ask you some questions. Okay, welcome to the House of Strauss podcast. We are very excited because we are joined not by an NBA player, by a media member, a new media member, a rising media star, the host of the Rogue Bogues podcast. I nearly stuck the intro, nearly did it well. We were joined by Andrew Bogut. How you doing, Andrew?
I'm good. Don't label me as media though. We're rogue media.
Okay. I don't know. Okay, well, what is that distinction to you? What is the difference?
I don't have a boss telling me what I need to write and talk about.
No, that's okay. So that's interesting. You don't have a boss. I guess there's one main question I want to ask about your podcast, and I'm enjoying it a lot, and it really brings people behind the scenes of the NBA, I think, in a new way. But I think the main question when you told me that you were doing it is why? You know, you've got money. You could do a variety of things in basketball. Why a podcast that you're presumably not doing with financial interest primarily in mind?
Well, I like to talk shit, number one. I feel like I have a lot of good stories to tell. Not only NBA, or on the court, but off the court as well, just through some of the people that I've been lucky enough to meet, whether that be in the business world, in Silicon Valley, wherever it may be. Some of the opportunities that I've had have been unbelievable. So they're great stories that I think people would love to hear down the track. I've got access to a pretty vast network of people to get on as guests down the way. And I just don't think anybody... I mean, there's a lot of podcasts out there, and I don't want to knock at any other podcast because everyone has their niche, but I just want it to be a blunt, honest take on things. You could call me a cynic at times, but I don't think anyone's given the honest truth of what really goes on behind the scenes, whether it's, you know, what's going on with player trades, with free agency, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then there's the off-court stuff as well, like, you know, eventually we'll touch on, you know, player foundations. What does that mean? Are guys really doing it mainly for charity, or are they doing it for their own, you know, image and perception of what they're really like? But when, you know, you're behind closed doors, some guys are the opposite, you know, so stuff like that where people really don't get that side of things because it's not through a, you know, as you like to do Raymond Ritter's voice, it's not through a Raymond Ritter or a PR person. It's not scripted. It's not someone that's told, you know, you can't talk about this or talk about that. So I think the fans and our listeners have really enjoyed that part of the podcast.
Yeah, I think people are drawn to it more so than they admit. I think there's an assumption that people only want the happy story or the sanitized story. And the Players Tribune, I think, was born out of that. And I think they've done some content that people liked and were into. But I don't think that people are incredibly drawn to that sanitized version. I don't, frankly, no offense to your former colleagues, I don't think players always understand what's interesting about them to other people. It's hard to know that. I don't know what's interesting about me if anything's interesting about me. I mean, I live with myself. So I think that really sanitized version where they're afraid of people getting the wrong implication or assuming too much based on this or that sometimes makes the stories that are told pretty boring. And it seems like you've established a pretty good instinct for knowing that people are into the dirty NBA behind the scenes. And it doesn't diminish their love for the sport. They can still love the NBA and be pretty cynical about it and find it hilarious that Steven Jackson is demanding that Hammond trades him, for instance, in the way that he did.
Yeah, that's a point of it. I think it is maybe a niche, but look, how much ESPN fluff pieces can you read till you want to, you know, jump off a building, essentially? I mean, it's some of those pieces are good, don't get me wrong, but most of them are fluff and most of them are through an agency or through a PR conduit with a team where it's, you know, it's all orchestrated. So that's kind of the rogue name of this is we want to talk about things that at times are uncomfortable and we want to talk about things that people might find controversial. And I'm not looking to be like a lot of the podcasts, if you listen to it, a lot of it's non-controversial. It's just, you know, opinions, but some of it does get controversial. But this isn't a thing where we just want to be controversial to get headlines. You know, if we happen to get headlines about certain things, fantastic, but not the reason why I'm doing it. And then obviously I have the other parts of the podcast too. So we just launched a car chat. So a passion of mine is muscle cars. So a good friend of mine who knows the muscle car scene. So that's been actually pretty popular, which has been kind of fun to watch those numbers grow from a basketball player talking about cars. And then the other one is the My Journey, which is a whole different aspect of my life from basically childhood to now. And basically I wanted to do an autobiography, what it would read like in a book, but via podcast. And I think I'm setting a record because I don't think anyone's done that as far as a professional athlete retiring and then kind of orchestrating from the beginning of their, you know, basically when they were born, their childhood, high school, all the way to retirement. So that's been a fun one to do. And you talked about like the why am I doing this? The My Journey part has actually been pretty cool to relive kind of my career right as I retired. So it's given me something to bring back some fond memories of my career. And I've had numerous people on throughout that journey in the first five or six episodes, whether it be in high school or college and coaches and teammates. And I'll continue to do that throughout, you know, those journey episodes as we get closer towards, you know, the tail end of my career.
Has your perspective on your career changed now that you're one step outside of it and you're reliving it in a way?
Somewhat. I think it has. I think it, you know, it gives you an opportunity to, as a plane goes over my head. So yeah, I'm in a flight path, people. So yeah, it just gives me an opportunity to really realize kind of how good I was in college. Like I don't really like talking about my career individually and my numbers and all that, but like looking back at the college career, I think I did some pretty special things and that was really, really cool to see.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to get into some of the modern day takes on basketball right now. And I think I'm going to ask about Steph because he's playing unbelievably, but this is interesting to me. And I kind of want to follow this track a bit. I'm wondering, what were your expectations for yourself when you're coming out of college? And I think the other demarcation point would be that year with the Bucks where it was coming together pre-injury. Like, did you think, like, what was your ceiling in your estimation? What was your self-conception of what you were going to be as a basketball player?
I didn't know. I mean, my career path and journey, it came together so quickly. Like, I was a kid that didn't make any of the, you know, the best teams as a junior. You know, 14, 15, 16, I was still getting cut from, you know, my state representative team in Australia, which is equivalent to like an AAU team. I didn't even make those teams as a young kid in America. That's what the equivalent would be from Australia. So, and then within a two to three year period, I went to the Australian Institute of Sport in 2002, and then college 2003-04, and then drafted in 2005. Like that's how quickly it happened for me. And so I didn't really have time to even think about that. It was always kind of the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. And I guess for me, I wasn't ready to be a physical presence in the NBA my rookie year. I knew that. Like I was in pounds, what, 225, 230 coming out of my sophomore year going into the NBA to play the five spot. So against Shaq and Dwight and these kind of guys. I knew my body wasn't physically ready, but I also knew I had one of the, you know, an unbelievable year numbers wise and was, you know, won all the college awards and Naismith and the Wooden and all that kind of stuff that I was going to be a top five pick. So I'm not going to then go back to college for a junior year, risk injury and risk all that. So I had to kind of go, but I knew I wasn't really ready my rookie year physically. So I just spent a lot of time in the weight room and I knew I could be a double-double player in the NBA. And that was kind of my goal. And I achieved that. For the most part, I mean, my numbers languished off once I got to the Warriors a little bit, playing more of a role. But I mean, if I stayed in Milwaukee my whole career and or you know, down that way and just was the number two, number one, number two, number three option, my numbers would have remained better. But I gave up a bit of numbers to be part of something very special. And yeah, I mean, that 2009-10 year for me was my best year. It was 16-10 a night and really, really big impact on the defensive end and was really learning how to play defensively. I was labeled a defensive bust coming out of college, funnily enough, by all the pundits. And it was a case of in college, I couldn't really foul out. I couldn't afford to foul out in college. So at times I had to pick my spots and couldn't go for every block shot and couldn't take risks that I could then in the NBA because without me on the floor, our team wasn't very good. So I got labeled as defensive bust. So I always laugh at that because, you know, you look years down the track, I led the league in blocks 1 year and then made an all defensive team and was part of one of the best defensive teams in NBA history. So it kind of went full circle.
Well, I mean, my impression of a lot of athletes is that they're almost delusionally confident and they need to be. You need to be delusionally confident in order to achieve something so abnormal, but it kind of sounds like you didn't have that going in because I think some guys, if they're the number one pick, they're going, I'm going to be the next Tim Duncan. And, you know, am I wrong to get that wasn't your perspective when you got drafted into the league?
Yeah, I wish I probably had that more, to be quite honest with you, Ethan. I think it would have probably helped me a little bit more in that environment in the NBA, with especially when I came in the league. It still kind of is the same, but it's not a very team-orientated league. There is probably four or five teams that have that mix every season of guys that, you know, are playing for the right reasons and aren't playing for their free agency, aren't playing to get a bonus in their contract, you know, and those teams are very, very rare. I was fortunate enough to be part of one or two, you know, two great years in Golden State, but that whole campaign with Golden State was guys like that. So I probably wish I had more of that, but coming from Australia and the mentality over here, it was always team first. And we hear team first in all professional sport contexts, and a lot of it's complete bullshit. I'd say 80-90% of it's complete bullshit, because at the end of the day, if you tell a guy he can get two more rebounds and get an extra $1 million, he's going to do that over winning a game most times. And that's just the reality of the business. And that's when big money's involved, that's what you got to deal with. But I probably wish I had more of that, to be honest. It's just one of those things I never really could kind of pump my own tires and promote myself. I just never was that guy. But what I learned down the track of my NBA career is, I can't remember who it was, a teammate told me, because I used to give guys a lot of shit that pump their own tires and that would promote themselves, and he said, look, if you're not your biggest fan, who is? And that kind of rung true in a way. You know, it was kind of the anti-Australian mentality, because we were all team first, and if you try to pump yourself up at all here in Australia, like the media, the fans, the people will just cut you down straight away. They absolutely despise that. So I had to kind of find that balance, and I just never really got it right, I don't think.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you mentioned those dynamics and the dynamics that inspire people towards selfishness in the NBA. Is that why maybe, this might sound like a strange thing, but when I talk to fans and they ask about players, they're shocked that players aren't friends with each other more often, that it's actually a rarity, players on teams. And I know that you were friends with Harrison Barnes, for instance, but do you think those dynamics account for why players who are teammates aren't friends as often as fans might think?
Yeah, there's a number of factors, though. I think it's money's one of them. Being the number one guy on a team's another. So if you have a star on the team already, and then you draft you have the first pick or the second pick, then that's supposed to be the next star. There's usually those guys will butt heads eventually. There's that. There's, you know, the team has only a certain amount of cap space with two or three agents coming up that year. There's a laundry list of things. And you got to remember, a lot of guys are young kids coming from college, very impressionable. They're getting advice from their agents mainly, possibly their family. You're better than him. You should be playing more minutes than him. And that can become toxic. And we see that a lot. And that's just, they're the perils of Hollywood. They're the perils of the NBA. They're the perils of the NFL. I mean, it's just something you got to deal with. And I guess coming from a team first atmosphere, it was hard for me at times to see that. And it just, at times it was normalized when it probably shouldn't have been. And that's the frustrating thing about professional sports, is there's just so many things going on behind the scenes that people would have no idea about that contribute to guys, you know, getting traded, free agents, whatever it is. And that's just the harsh reality of what you have to deal with.
Is there a bond with a teammate, especially a teammate in Golden State where you had great success, where you aren't necessarily friends, but there's something there. Because I feel like, because I was on the periphery of it, I'm not inside of it, but it seems like there's some sort of fraternal, some sort of something there, some sort of bond that's not friendship, but is profound. Is that there? Am I off base in thinking that's there?
It was with Golden State was the only team I felt that I was part of. And I've been on, you know, towards the end, like five or six teams. And that team we built that culture to an extent, but we just had good guys. We had good people within the organization. We had good players that were very talented, but good players. It starts with your leader. So Steph Curry is a very humble, soft-spoken, very good, fun guy to be around. So that was one of the teams where, you know, you just enjoyed being around each other. It was one of the few teams, I've spoken about it many times and most people probably heard the story, but it was one of the few teams I've been on where we'd get most of the team to a team dinner on the road every road trip. So what I mean by that is, you know, when you go on a road trip, ever rarely do players eat together. Most teams I was on, there'll be little cliques within the clique. So there'll be three guys that like to go party. There'll be four guys that like to go and eat dinner together. There'll be two guys that stay in their room, whatever, right? Golden State was one of the few teams where we'd say, all right, 7 o'clock dinner, whoever wants to come meet in the lobby. And at the start, we get four or five guys. And then as things progressed throughout a season, we started getting 8, 9 guys, 10, 11 guys. And then most trips, you know, we'd be full. And it was just an awesome atmosphere to be part of.
Do you think that was a top-down situation or was that bottom-up? And that was just the collection of players happened to form that sort of culture? Or was everything in the organization just clicking?
It was probably a mix of everything, but look, shit, you're on the road. Like, what else are you doing? You have to eat anyway. So, like, you can spend the 2 hours with your teammates and eat and then go do, if you want to go party and go do different things, you can go and do that after. So I think we understood that and it was just cool to be a part of. And look, 1 through 15 on a roster traveling together, there's going to be guys that don't like each other. That's the reality. I'll bet my house on it. There's going to be two guys that severely dislike each other. But you kind of knew somewhat, but guys kind of, to build that culture, like sucked it up a little bit, right? You know, and it does get hard. You're spending basically road trips. You see each other all day, every day, almost every minute of the day, film sessions, team meetings, bus, airplanes. So it can get a little antsy. And that's when you see guys that don't like each other. Sometimes on NBA teams get to fisticuffs eventually or some bad blood spills. But on that team, I think guys understood, hey, I don't get along too well with this guy. I'll be cordial. I'll have a chat to him every now and then, and then just won't cause any issues. But what those team dinners also did, and those environments where we were hanging out without being forced to, so it wasn't mandatory by management or coaches. It was completely voluntary and driven by the players. Was you start to learn things about guys, like, hey, I didn't know this happened to you in your upbringing. I didn't know you faced these challenges. I didn't know, you know, you were a single parent family. And once you start learning those intimate details of somebody, I think you will go to battle and fight even harder for him on the court. When it's just player A versus player B and the contract sagas and all that, there's not that human element. So I believe those team bonding meals and all that kind of built that human element between us where we had each other's back a little bit more.
I remember, according to legend, it was maybe even pivotal in that Memphis series in 2015. What was it? You guys we went down 1-2 and Steph was struggling. And then you went to the Blue City Cafe? I think maybe D Lee and Steph to just try to reconnect, if I'm remembering properly. I feel like that was like a road fork pivotal point. The midpoint of that series that's been a little bit lost to history, because after you have a lot of success, people act like it was always going to go that way and it all came easily. But because now I'm going down the memory lane. Do you have any memories of what it was like in the midpoint of that series?
Yeah, I do. It was actually funny because that was probably Memphis was really the last teams left that was a team that went big. they had Zebo and Gasol, so two slower bigs, and we were kind of half small ball with myself at the 5 and Draymond at the 4. So it was kind of the clash of small ball versus big ball, and that was the last time we saw big ball since. But yeah, that was a pivotal series for us. We made some great adjustments, but I guess when you have those tough losses and things aren't going well, there's a lot of teams that everyone just goes to their room and it goes quiet till the next game or the next training session. We were one of those few teams that were like, let's just address this and just call it for what it is. And sometimes your feelings get hurt along the way and you don't want to hear it, but that's just the way we kind of addressed it. So then by the time you get to that next shoot around or training session, that's all behind you and you've already discussed it and it's out of the window and you can have a fresh page that next day. And obviously that series, if people remember, we made an adjustment with putting myself on Tony Allen. So Tony Allen had an influential part, a big influence of those in those first three games of guarding Clay and Steph during different periods of that game very, very well. And we try to figure out a way of getting him out of the game, and it was by I think we started Harrison on Gasol, Draymond on Zebo, and they were just told to front the post at all costs, and I would just stand behind him and leave Tony Allen on the perimeter just roaming around. And I think game four, I remember we did it, and Tony Allen caught the ball on the wing and was like, "Why is no one guarding me?" And he shot a three and made it. And it was probably the best thing that could happen to us because he came down, I think, and shot the next two or three and bricked him. And then I think he hurt his hamstring after that. And then he was basically out of the series after that and didn't play. And we go from down 2-1 to winning three straight and going to the finals.
Yeah, I think that's actually a pivotal series, not just in the history of the Warriors, but in the history of the league, because you started seeing that Tony Allen treatment in a bunch of different playoff series after that one, after it proved so successful. I remember afterwards in the locker room after that game, game four, I think, Draymond just said, and the statute of limitations is out on these kinds of things, he just said, the series is over. Like, they're not going to win. I mean, after that adjustment, they're dead. And were you that confident at that point after that adjustment that it was effectively a kill shot and there was no strategic recourse that the Grizzlies had?
Yeah, somewhat. I wasn't that confident. Draymond's obviously, a very confident person. We were obviously confident. We had, two more home games out of the next three, and we felt like momentum shifted. We felt like we took their biggest punch the first three games, and they played almost perfect basketball those first three games, and we only got one win. But getting Tony Allen off the court, although he wasn't great for him offensively, he was huge for him defensively. That was that year where he was just yelling all defense every other possession and yelling to the crowd and everything. And he was a beast perimeter defender. So the fact that we could get him out of there because he wasn't an offensive threat and they took him out for long periods worked in our favor, because then Clay and Steph started getting rolling. And one, we all know what happens once those two guys get rolling. It's pretty hard to turn off. So it was a huge adjustment. It was a ballsy move by Steve Kerr to do. Even when he told me about it, I had to kind of, stop and think for a second, like, wait, he wants me to guard Tony Allen? He's like, yep, I want you to guard Tony Allen. We're going to dare shoot him. We're just going to make him feel uncomfortable the way he has to shoot the ball, because everyone's like, what are you doing? You're wide open. And it worked perfectly.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
Yeah, it was, they were just all kinds of fucked up. And it was an interesting thing to watch. And fortunately, the media seating at FedEx is incredible. So I've got a lot of memories of that particular series. And I guess we'll spend a little bit more time in the past and then fast forward to the future. I'm wondering, when did you know that this Warriors team was a championship contender, maybe even a little bit better than that? When was it obvious to you?
I think just that second year under Mark Jackson, we showed spurts of what we could do, but we were very isolation driven under Mark. So he was an old school type coach where if you scored the possession before, you were getting the ball in the next possession. If you scored again, you were getting the next possession. And then when it dried up, we'd be like, all right, let's go to the next guy. That was kind of what our offense was based around, which there's pros and cons to it, and the cons are that all of a sudden a team makes an adjustment and Steph has 50 in the fourth and they start blitzing and double teaming. You throw it to a Harrison Barnes in the corner or whoever it is, Draymond Green, and they haven't touched the ball for 10 straight possessions, and then they have to knock down this very important shot to keep momentum going. It's a hard shot to make. And that was the issue that we generally had. So we knew we had all the tools. Clay was becoming a very, very good defender at the time. He was underrated his first couple of seasons, and then people started to realize this guy's a really good defender, but it just got hidden by his shooting because everyone just focused on his offense. Steph really bought in defensively and got much better, and then we went with that lineup with Draymond. Then Dealey accepted his bench role and was huge for us, especially in the finals off the bench. So I think guys accepting their roles and really not causing too many issues around different balances of the team is where we turned the corner. But Steve Kerr came in. I mean, to some extent, he inherited a pot of gold. Not going to sugarcoat it. He got a very, very talented roster, and he made slight, subtle tweaks. He didn't change anything defensively, really. Obviously, Ron Adams came in and did a fantastic job just making sure we kept our defensive principles. But the only changes that Steve stressed were first day of training camp, he had us doing high school ball handling drills, and I still remember Draymond Green losing his shit doing it. Like, he was like, what the fuck are we doing? This is bullshit. We're not in high school. And I could see, I knew what Steve was doing. He was reiterating the fact that then he was going to follow that up with, you guys turned the ball over. You guys were a top five turnover team last season. If we get that to that league average, you guys will win a championship. Stop throwing the fucking ball away. And he obviously stressed that by making us do mundane, boring, stupid drills early on in training camp. So that flicked the switch in our minds. Okay, like, let's do this. And then the other thing they did was they charted passes per possession. So when we had more than 4+ passes per possession, I think we were shooting 55-60%, if I remember correctly, which is outrageous. When we had less than 2 passes, I think it was the drop was, you know, below, I think it was in the 40s, maybe even the high 30s. So I'd have to look at the exact numbers, but that's the ballpark we're talking about. So Steve Kerr stressed, no, less turnovers, move the ball more, you guys win a championship. And you fast forward a year down the track and we win a championship.
Yeah, I'm remembering, I was told around that time that Steve didn't want to tell Steph about the turnover issue until they got a few games in and it became an obvious issue, because there was a sensitivity to how you guys are having success before Steve came in, and you don't want to just come in and tell the best player on the team that he's fucking up. And so you have to let it go wrong a little bit before coming in there. And does that seem like that was true to the Kerr approach to coaching and personality management?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I don't know the exact psychology behind whether he did that or not, but I think Steph's a tough one because the freedom and beauty that he plays with, you don't want to turn that off or tamper with it too much. But there was an argument to be made that even Steph will tell you at times he'd get loose and throw that behind the back pass and it'd go over someone's head and out of bounds, and they're the ones that irk Steve Kerr and probably even Steph to an extent. But that was just the beauty and flow that Steph played with, that he'd be so loose and free out there that sometimes he'd throw one into the stands and you just have to adjust. The problem was, if it was a crucial possession or something that was vital, it became a bigger point. And I think Steve's point was, especially in the second halves, like, I want you to kind of be a bit more kind of, you know, fluent with the basketball rather than loose. And in the first half, you know, if you throw one or two away, so be it. But once it gets a bit tighter, let's be a bit more fundamental. And Steph, you know, to his credit, he wasn't a superstar that, you know, a modern day superstar was like, let me do me, coach, or, you know, you're hating or this, that, that's my game. He kind of took it in stride and adapted. They showed him on film and he was phenomenal throughout that campaign when I was there.
Yeah, truly so. I'm kind of wondering, and this will probably be around the last question in memory lane, how do you feel about the 73-win season looking back on it? You know, how bittersweet is it? How much positive, how much negative, considering, I mean, it was just such a moment in time. And again, being on the periphery of it, with you guys were being followed around and screamed at like you were the Beatles. It was insanity. And the amount of success and attention, but then for it to not end ultimately in a championship, how do you process that now that you look back, now that you're retired, looking back on the historic season?
Oh, it sucks to an extent, because we couldn't put the cherry on top, and no one's going to really talk about that that season being a success, even though it was historic season numbers wise. So, and just the way it went down, the circumstances, give all the credit to Cleveland, and that's the beauty of a seven game series, right? Like the momentum can shift two games at a time, and they saw some momentum shift slightly with the Draymond suspension, and then I did my, you know, busted up my knee due to a somersault by J.R. Smith after I blocked his shot that just completely hampered me for 6 or 7 weeks. But yeah, the momentum shifted after that. We lost, obviously. I felt like I was having a really good series in that final series. I sucked the final series before, and this one I was like, look, I'm gonna have a better series. And defensively, I was playing really well. I was just making sure that I was floating around that paint and not giving LeBron, you know, easy looks at coming in and throwing down dunks and getting power layups for and one. So I was either blocking his shot, getting there early, so he'd have to either kick it or shoot a floater kind of shot, or I'd foul the shit out of him. So I felt like at times he was looking for where I was at when I was on the court. And offensively, I was doing my job and getting a few lobs and putbacks and all that kind of stuff. So I felt like I was playing really well. And then so the Draymond thing happens, and then you take me out of the lineup. Then we're asking Festus to start games and play more minutes than he's been playing. And the rotation kind of went out of whack a little bit, and we just couldn't recover. And Cleveland, to their credit, they, you know, Kyrie hits that big shot, but they recovered that series and stole it from us. And it's a bitter point to this day. So I appreciate not talking about it too much.
Wow. I know. I figured that over time it just gets more positive in the retrospect, but I guess it's more present than that. I love how you wanted to change the topic and I went back to it immediately.
No, I'm just giving you shit. I don't care. I can talk about it. But no, look, I mean, it would have been just so nice to be that team and have that nice poster on the wall that said 73-9 NBA champions, not 73-9. Where do they finish again? You know, so it's it was a crazy year though, man. Like there was so many games that year that we shouldn't have won. Like it was like, if you look back at those games for fans out there, even yourself, like you look at some of those games and we're going into the three-quarter time, start of the fourth, and we're down 10 or 15, and then the Splash Brothers do their thing. We get some stops and change the game in a 4 or 5 minute period. It was just outrageous. Like we shouldn't have won that many games. Looking back, we stole probably, we would have stole 5 to 10 games that year where we had no business winning. Yeah. Even games where Mo Spates would come in and bring back a 17-point deficit to 4 points, and then Steph and Clay have checked back in the game and it's back in the balance. Like, it was just crazy shit, and it just felt like once we got rolling, we just knew we weren't going to lose, and the teams that beat us basically had to play a perfect game for 48 minutes.
Do you think you win the championship if you don't go for 73?
That's the argument, right? I mean, we discussed it in season. There were some players that were pro all in for 73 and try to break the record. And there were some players that were like, hey, who gives a shit about 73 if we don't win the chip? Let's make sure we rest guys towards the end of the season. So damned if you do, damned if you don't. Who, you know, I mean, you can look back now and say, oh, well, you know, we should have listened to the guys that wanted to rest guys. But, you know, would the rest have made a difference for Draymond's suspension? Would the rest have made a difference for my knee and Andre's back and all that? Probably not. Maybe Andre's back's the only one that you can argue, but the rest is history.
Were you on the don't go for it camp, or were you on the let's go for it camp?
I was more in the middle. I was case by case. I was like, if guys are banged up and guys need rest, I think they should, you know, get that rest. But you know, there were guys that were like, nah, we need to grind and get this and set a record forever. So I was probably more slighted towards the left side of making sure that we win the championship first.
Yeah. I suspect Andre was don't go for it. Am I wrong to suspect that?
Yeah, he was definitely don't go for it. I think he was far on the don't go for it side. Yeah, he was pretty boisterous about it too, you know. And there are debates we have. Like, no one's right, no one's wrong. These were things we had in the locker room, and there were guys that were pro it and guys that were against it. And, you know, yeah.
Draymond was very much go for it.
He was, yeah. Draymond definitely was. And that's Draymond. Like, he's hard on his sleeve. Like, we want to, you know, F the records. Like, we're going to break all that shit. Fuck everyone. Like, that's his mentality. That's why he's so successful. Without that mentality, he wouldn't be playing in the NBA. You know, he's a lot of his skill set is his mentality. He's just, he's a pit bull and a terrier, and you know, he's going to go out there and fight you with whatever he has in his hand, and that's why he's so good.
Yeah, Andre's motivation's always been interesting, the way he describes it. It almost reminds me of the surfers I grew up with, where they're just chasing a kind of a flow state. And at least in how he described the game, it seemed like he was always chasing this flow and this perfection of the team really clicking, that isn't necessarily connected to going for a particular record. And I'm not even asking you a question. I'm just trying to make myself sound smart with an observation.
He's play basketball the right way at all costs. So I've mentioned this, I think, on one of the episodes of the basketball podcast that I do, but he could not stand low IQ basketball players, like to the point where it'd be awkward, because he'd just be, you know, he'd be in them, or he'd just go to management and like, get them the fuck out of here. Like they can't fit in here. And I get it to an extent, because, you know, the way we played, a lot of the stuff we did then was read and react. It wasn't some, we had quick hitter plays and all that kind of stuff, but within 40 minutes of the 48 minutes we're playing is that flow state, that read and react, that, hey, when I go here, you better have my back. Hey, when he comes off this way, you better space this way. And if you weren't adapt to that, if you were from a system in high school or college that was very regimented, where you needed to be told where to go and stand, you couldn't play with us. And Andre was, he would lose his shit. Like, and that goes back to what you're saying, that flow state. He wanted high IQ guys. He hated guys that would make, that had bad habits. Even like, we'd be up 30 and we'd put in our bench guys that don't play much, and they'd be out there fucking around. He would lose his shit after the game. And we win by 25, but he would lose it and be like, hey, you know, you guys are going to have opportunities where you're going to get in games that are vital minutes. You guys are fucking around during garbage time. Like, it's unacceptable. And blunt and dry, as you know, Andre, sometimes guys don't know if he's joking, yeah. Is he serious? And that's the beauty of Andre Iguodala. And I'm still really good friends with Andre. I have a lot of time for him. I think he's a real fun guy to be around once you get to know him. But if you don't know him very well, you kind of like myself, probably you don't know if he's being serious or if he's really having a shot at you.
Oh, yeah. Both of you, very similar. And I felt similarly about the both of you, where I remember, at least early on, you know, one week I would hate Andre and like you. And then the next week I would it would be reversed. And ultimately, I came to like both of you because I prefer an interesting asshole to an uninteresting an uninteresting guy who's just very nice all the time. And he was. I mean, there was some harshness to the way he dealt with people, certainly, and you needed to look beyond it. And I remember he would read the box score sometimes. And I just remember after that game against Boston, where I think you pulled out this win against Boston in Boston in the 73-win season, and he's just reading off the box score how many times Ian Clark shot. Might have been 9 times in, I don't know, 10 minutes. I'm just making up numbers. But he went, ah, I'd like to shoot 9 times in 10 minutes. And I'm looking at Ian, and Ian's like nervously laughing. And it's a little bit of a needling. But like the J.K. Simons and Whiplash, it's only because he wanted the best. I don't think that there was necessarily, he wasn't in it for the malice and the cruelty. He was in it for the result. And sometimes being in it for the result requires some cruelty.
Yeah, and that was just the method of his madness. That was the way he went about things. There's people that motivate you directly. There's people that do it subtly. There's people that do it sarcastically. He was probably more that sarcastic side of kind of making you feel a little bit like an idiot, but like, but he's kind of right as well. That was his way of doing things. And yeah, I just know I've got a lot of stories about guys that we either had in training camp or even down the track after I left, I heard stories about certain guys that he's just like, yeah, you can't play here. You need to get out of here. It's just like, fair enough.
The NBA is not for the faint of heart. And I think that's something that fans might not understand it. It was interesting. I don't know if you caught this story, but Clay was on the Warriors broadcast and
Rodney. Oh, awesome. Yeah, I texted him about it.
Rodney Magruder got in a bit of a dust up with the Warriors. I can't even remember what the genesis was, but they asked Clay, what do you think Rodney's mad about? And he said, I don't know. Maybe he's mad because he's just not going to be in the league pretty soon. And a lot of people took umbrage at that. I mean, obviously, Magruder and his teammates did, understandably. But fans were so scandalized and mad about it if they didn't like Clay. And I thought to myself, you just saw a little insight into what the NBA is actually like and how guys actually talk. Can you expound on that, that the NBA, for all the good things and how funny everything is, and there is camaraderie, that there's just this, there's this cruelty to it that I think a lot of fans are shielded from.
Yeah, there is. There is. The NBA locker room is probably one of the most judgmental places on earth. As much as people like to think it isn't, as much as players are on their best behavior when people like yourself are standing in the room, and even times you'll see the bad aside, but not to full context, but it's a judgmental place. It comes down to what car you drive, what clothes you're wearing, what the girl you're with looks like. It's very competitive. So if you buy the nice house, I'm going to buy a bigger and better one, and you got the nice car, I'm going to get the even sportier version. And it's a judgmental place, no matter how people want to sugarcoat it. And that's, look, I don't want to talk politics, but when Trump made those silly comments around, you know, it's locker room talk. And then there were a few players notably that came out and said that doesn't exist. I was on the floor laughing at that because it exists every game. Every time you're in a locker room, there's some form of locker room talk. And if people don't want to believe that, I mean, that's up to your own kind of devices. Seen it. I mean, and that, I got to laugh at it.
I had a similar reaction because I had just heard unbelievable things that would get you fired at pretty much any job. And I'm the guy where they try not to talk about, like, try not to talk so much when I'm around, you know? And so you can only imagine, or I could only imagine what it's like when I'm not around. And so, yeah, I had a similar reaction to it, which is, you know, this is unbelievable. Some of the things that get said. I think Charles Barkley once said that the NBA locker room is racist, it's sexist, it's homophobic, and I miss it. You know, that's the NBA.
It is, man. Like, it is. And it's not a shot at anyone. It's not throwing darts at people that can't respond. It's fact. It happens. A nice journalist reporter walks by, female, guys are going to be making comments. That's just, if you think that's wrong.
Yeah, you tuned up that Utah Jazz reporter. You guys really went at him for relaying the private conversation. I remember that one time.
Yeah, that's... You know, the media stuff, I like the access the NBA gives, and I think the NBA has built its brand on giving so much access to anyone, but there needs to be a line sometimes. I mean, there were times where we had, especially journalists from China, like we'd have random, I don't think they were journalists. I think the NBA, they were either some billionaires or millionaires, friends from China that got a hold of the NBA, and we'd have like random people in our locker room sometimes that wouldn't ask a question. During a media availability, I caught a few of them asking Steph or Clay for a selfie, like stuff like that. And I think that then makes guys like yourself, the actual professional, you know, journalists that are doing the right thing, makes everyone get tainted with that same brush. But yeah, I mean, there's definitely some people in there that you want to watch what you say when they're around, and that aren't really journalists. Glorified bloggers at times. So you really have to kind of be careful, but it's a tough argument. The NBA does such a great job of providing content, so you want to let it all in, but at the same time, they probably need to better scrutinize who they're letting in at times.
Well, the rules sort of changed and the amount of exposure changed. And that team, there was just such a ravenous appetite for all things about it that they didn't know what to do a lot of the time. I remember in Utah, when fans were trying to get to Steph and trying to get an autograph, there was just this crowd surge and the railing popped off and people fell out because these just structures weren't.
Oh, yeah, down in the tunnel, like the elevated tunnel, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. I remember.
Yeah, down there. Yeah. To me, that was almost a metaphor for what was happening in general, which was it was just too much for what the rules were at that time. And I can certainly understand it from a player's perspective. I feel like I would be very paranoid in that space if media is milling about. But I also think sometimes players are too controlled by that paranoia or that negativity. It just blows my mind how often players don't just do a modicum of glad handing, because it really does pay off. We as the media, we're cheap whores, you know. Jamal Crawford, he knows every media member's name. He says hi to everybody. He's really nice. And no shocker, Sixth Man of the Year award keeps coming up and he keeps getting it. And it's funny to me that it should be part of rookie training that if you just say the media member's name and bullshit with them a little bit, your coverage is going to improve markedly. And it's just funny to me how often it goes the other way.
Which goes to, will Kevin Durant need to average 40, 20, and 20 to get another MVP vote ever again? You're a bit of cause of that, actually. We can discuss that. You're the cause of KD leaving the Bay Area, right?
That's what you're convinced of? I think you know too much to even come close to thinking that.
That's the public perception, and we'll just stick with that.
I mean, look, I think a lot of blame. Some of it is Steve's fault. Some of it's Draymond's fault. And look at you. You didn't help much. You came in late in the action and I didn't see him stay. You know, it's a lot of people stab Caesar.
Yeah. My point with KD is he's probably the furthest from schmoozing the media. And it will affect his voting at times, whether he's in an MVP race, which could be this season. He's having a great year again, coming back from that injury. If it's top three, him, LeBron, Luka, let's say, you know it's going to sway against him at some point. And it's just the reality of that human element of, unfortunately, as much as I probably don't like to believe, is media people are human beings too, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, with him, it's also complicated because he can be one of the most engaging people to speak with. If he's in the right mood or if he likes you.
Yeah,
he can be fantastic. And especially he likes giving a lot of takes. He likes giving takes on other sports. He loves breaking down the game. I mean, he loves breaking down.
He's pretty well read.
Basketball. Yeah, he's an interesting guy. I mean, I used to tell him it's funny that you hate the media so much because this could be your job in the future. This is where you would fit in. You would be great. You would be great on one of these shows. And there is something ironic to me about that he hates Barkley so much and some of these other guys because that would be his role. And so I don't necessarily think he has a poisonous relationship with media. I think that he had a bad one, certainly, with me included at the end there in Golden State. But he's not one of these guys where it's just completely negative and completely bad. I mean, on a very lower level, JaVale McGee was kind of like that. And I think it's because he got burned and there was the Shaq and a fool stuff. But when he was in, when he was with the Warriors, it was just a wall coming up in front of him. And it's understandable because, like you say, just as media people are human, so too are players. But man, you get a lot of mileage just from some pleasantries, and you get a lot of good coverage just from the name alone, which costs you nothing. It costs you nothing to just say somebody's name and say what's up, but that goes a tremendous way.
That's why if you're Australian, you can just say, hey mate, that was my out. You don't have to remember names. Hey mate, how are you?
Yeah. Well, that works too. You don't even have to remember the name. If you just say, how are you? Just start, asking questions. I think that's all you got to do, really. So, yeah. I mean, well, fast forwarding, maybe a little bit to the MVP debate, because I think Steph is knocking on the door of it. And I wrote about it. Plus 1,100 for his MVP odds when I wrote about it. I'm just watching him control an opponent's entire defense on the ball, off the ball, making incredible plays, looking like, those MVP seasons. And I'm wondering what your takeaway is from watching him right now, because we're talking about the flow state and he's not operating with a team that can be in that flow state. So it's a bit of a different situation. So what's your impression watching Steph right now?
Oh, it's been fun to watch. And I had the Warriors making the playoffs, much to the detriment of a lot of people. I thought they'd be somewhere between, 6 and 10, but I had them in there just based on Steph having those nights. I just thought he'd have 20, 30 nights where he's unconscious and making everything, and it's proven right to this point. They're right in the mix to make it. But yeah, look, I don't think they're deep enough to do any damage in there. I think they'll make it. And I think it's a balance of MJAC, Steph, and Steve Kerr, Steph, where at times he needs to go straight ISO ball and just get his bucket. Cause like you said, they don't have that deep roster they once had. So he's had to adjust, and it probably was an adjustment for him going from, healthy Clay, KD, having a good balanced roster with different options, a good bench, to now no, you're our guy. We need you to score. We need you to score 35 plus for us to win. So I think he's readapted to that. And that's not an easy switch to make back and forth. And that's kind of the craziness of it all. It's you know, I went from being, I'm not comparing myself to Steph by any means, but I went from being a number one, number two option in Milwaukee to then becoming a 4, 5, 6 option in Golden State, which was hard. But then if I went somewhere and they said, oh, we need you to be that number one option again, it probably wouldn't have worked because I wouldn't have had that confidence and that body of work of continuously doing that. So the fact that Steph's just able to turn that switch on and fit in, you know, for a guy like that to fit in with a KD and a Clay and then now being again, okay, now we need you to be the guy again is pretty impressive in my opinion.
You mentioned on one of your podcasts about what he does off the ball and how younger players could learn something about it. Why do you think the specialty is so rare? I mean, I see these shooters who do a lot of work off the ball. They stick on rosters. They get paid. They often punch above their weight versus where they're drafted. Why? And I know you're a big guy and you're observing it from a different perspective. Why don't we see more of it?
Well, I don't know if you're in the text with myself and Mike Procopio, who's at Hoop Consultants, the co-host on the Rogue Bros, but We've been discussing that, and that's going to be one of the subjects on our pod in 2 days. Steph's one of the few superstars in the league that moves well off the ball at an elite level. It just doesn't happen these days much. And we tried to, I mean, I'll pose this question to you. Name me three guards that move like him off the ball in the last 10 years. I can name two straight away.
JJ Redick.
Okay, JJ Redick.
JJ Redick, Ray Allen.
Ray Allen, yeah. Reggie Miller, 10, 15 years ago. Yep. And then Rip Hamilton, right? Okay, so they're the guys that I would name as well. The one thing about those guys is none of them are point guards. He has an ability to handle the ball as much as you need him to, but then off the ball, he's okay giving the ball up. And now there is that confidence that he knows he's going to get it back, which does play in a part. But today's superstars need the ball. There's not many superstars that you can sell the dream of, hey, go run off 15 screens to get your shot up. It's just not going to happen. Yeah. Like guys are like, hey, let me get the ball, or let me get in my bag, and I want to create the assist, or I want to create the stat, or I want to create the score. I want to be involved in it. Whereas Steph's more than happy to move off the ball at an elite level, and that's hard to do. And I commend him for that because he's one of the few superstars that will give the ball up to potentially not get it back.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was a lot of the difference. I remember in the 2019 Western Conference Finals that you were in between him and Lillard, and Lillard's a fantastic player, but did not at that point have that. And eventually in the playoffs, you know, if you can only really beat a team in one particular way, it becomes a vulnerability. And Steph is just 24 seconds of pressure on the defense. And I don't think it gets enough credit. It's hard for fans, for maybe for the same reason that so many stars don't specialize in it, it doesn't get enough credit because we like to watch the ball. That's what we see. And we don't pay attention to everything happening outside of it. But
and you know, there's a flip side of this. Sorry to cut you off. There's a flip side of this. So your head coach.
No. What is it?
Your head coach comes to you as a superstar and says, late game, hey, we want you to be off the ball. What do you think is going to happen? What are most superstars going to do? You know, there's that part of it that people, they're going to pout. They're going to be pissed off about it. Oh, you're putting the number two guy, he's handling the ball now and he's going to take the shot. Well, it's like, no, we want you off the ball to create some space or some misdirection or whatever it is. And there's not many guys that would do that just based on, you're hating on me or like, what are my friends and family going to think watching this? What are fans going to think? I'm not taking the last shot. So there's some coaches out there that don't have the balls to do it because they know there's going to be repercussions of that down the line. And there's a lot of teams out there that have that. It's like, you know, I can't go to this guy and be like, hey, we're going to play you off the ball for 4 or 5 minutes. It's just not going to fly. And that's what I'm saying. The beauty of having, you know, Steph do that with the Warriors, even when you consider the roster isn't as deep as it once was, and him to be okay with that is phenomenal.
I mean, speaking of that, Steph had an interesting comment about James Wiseman, obviously the number two pick, Warriors center, who's going to be back soon, hopefully from his minor injury. And I think they had a really good game against Dallas and they were really moving the ball. And Steph said about implementing that style with the more traditional lineup when Wiseman comes back. It'll be good, I'm sure, for Wiseman to see how that ball was moving. And that he can play that way as well and still dominate the game the way he's capable of with his size and presence at the rim, end quote. And I thought about you when I saw that quote, because I'm wondering, as somebody who has played with the Warriors as a big man in that style, is it a style that is that can reward a big man who's giving up the ball? And I guess what I'm trying to say is, can Wiseman get 20 in this style, or is that unrealistic and he's got to adjust his expectations?
No, that's the hard thing with the Warriors' style and the flow of play. The bigs used generally as a facilitator at times and needs to be a big defensive presence, rebound, set good screens, and you get your little lob dunk and drop-off dunk. Now, where this is interesting is you've drafted a guy in the top five. So you've drafted one of the best players in the draft, best players in the rookie in his rookie class. He was the man in college. He had all the touches. He had post plays. He had all that kind of stuff. Well, now you're not being asked to do that, and it's one of the few teams in the NBA that that plays that style. Teams are going smaller and whatnot, but the Warriors are very predicated on, even if they go to the post, it's a misdirection to get a three up, you know? So it's going to be an adjustment for him. And I'm sure he's got people in his ear saying, you need more touches, you need more looks on the block. Why aren't they posting you up? And now he's a young fella that's 19, 20 that now needs to navigate all those people and figure out a way. But it is a unique, interesting style, and I've made that argument. Let's say Wiseman is in Washington right now on a bad team. He'd be putting up pretty big numbers, I would guess. You know, I think he'd be putting up probably almost double what he's putting up now, if not a little bit less, because he'd be getting all the touches and they'd be trying to develop him. Whereas the Warriors are developing him. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying they're not developing him, but the development isn't necessarily coming with 20 post touches a night. So it's a unique situation. You know, if he was a journeyman big man or a second round pick, you could be more okay with the way the direction's going. But probably for him, he's probably thinking, hey, I was drafted high. Like, why can't I get more of the ball, you know?
What's your assessment of him? I think you've seen a few Warriors games. What do you think about him?
I like him. I think he's very athletic. He can handle the ball. He can actually go point center at times, it looks like, once he gets that confidence up. But you can see he's figuring it out slowly. It's just going to take time, you know, timing, spacing, when to go, when not to go, all those things are hard to figure out getting into the NBA, especially on a team that's got greatness on it, and Steph and Clay and Draymond. So he has a great mentor in Draymond, a great mentor in Steph and Clay and those guys, and I think he'll continue to get better, but it's just going to take him time. You got to be patient. He's going to have those ups and downs. I think the Warriors fans at times have somewhat been spoiled with great teams and bigs that played a vital role, that knew how to play, knew how to get Steph open. It's going to take him some more time to figure that out. So just give him time. He's only a rookie, and I know, you know, sometimes we're too impatient and want him to be kind of a center of the past or fit in perfectly, but he's got to figure it out along the way. But long wingspan, can protect the rim as well. You can't teach those things. So I think he'll continue to get better. They'll work him out. I assume he'll play summer league if there is a summer league and get better in the off season and then come back for an even better sophomore year.
That's if your co-host doesn't trade him for Bradley Beal, at least. He's all in, man. You can tell he's a day-to-day basketball guy, because he wants to win. Pro wants to win right now, apparently.
Give him a bit of context, Ethan, so he doesn't look like a Looney Tune. But he was saying, if you want a top 15 player, you got to give something up that's going to hurt your soul or hurt your heart, or that you don't want to give up. And he's got a fair point there. You'd say Bradley Beal he'd be a top 15 player as of today, as it stands. So if you want to get a guy like that, you're going to have to give up something you don't want to give up. So it's a fair point.
It is a fair point. It is a good rule to go by. Semi-related to the draft picks. Why didn't you warn me that LaMelo was going to be this good? You played against him in the NBL. I was sandbagging him as a draft pick, and now I just look like a total idiot. Are you shocked by how LaMelo has played? He's playing better in the NBA, I would say, than he did in Australia. What's your take on this?
Definitely am shocked. I'm going to sit on my laurels. I'm going to say I definitely didn't think he'd be this good. I didn't think he'd be having the impact that he's having. I thought it'd take him some time to figure things out. I knew, at the point guard spot, you could see that he knew how to play. Out of pick and rolls, he was unbelievable, always made the right decision. I think a knock on him coming out was the whole you know, ball family dynamic. How's that all going to work? His dad, and that's been all pretty good up until this point. So I don't know what they've done in Charlotte. Maybe MJ met with the old man and said, hey, pipe down a little bit, settle down. But he's been fantastic. And I didn't see it coming. So I take the L on this one. I thought it would take him some time. I thought Hampton would be, when I first saw him the first game we played New Zealand, the first game we played Illawarra, I thought Hampton just had all the tools as well, long, athletic. I thought he'd be up there neck and neck with him, but it's been the opposite. He's been fantastic, and he shot the three ball much better than he did in the NBL. In the NBL, he didn't really shoot the three ball well, and he was inconsistent. He'd take some bad ones, some logo threes, and was very, very confident, but it wasn't really going in for him. And then he's got to the NBA, and I don't know what he's shooting at this point, but I've checked the stats at least the last 10 games.
Something like 36% around there.
And some of them threes. Yeah, like he's shooting long ones.
Yeah, I saw him get eaten alive by Hampton in some of those matchups and just get overwhelmed athletically by guys in the NBL. And I guess sticking with the NBL, if it is producing this level of talent, I got off the phone with Bob Myers before this podcast, and I asked Bob, hey, what do you want me to ask Bogut? And he wants the Justinian Jessup take, second rounder, drafted by the Warriors, playing now for LaMelo's old Illawarra Hawks. He wanted to know your Jessup take and what his comp is, was the question from Bob Myers.
Well, he's playing for one of the best coaches in NBL history. It's a guy named Brian Gorgian. He coached throughout the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s, one of the winningest coaches in NBL history. He went to China for 10 years, and he's just come back to help relaunch that Hawks franchise, which was struggling a little bit. Even with LaMelo financially, they're always battling, but they're doing very, very well. So he's with a very good coach, a very good program. I've watched a few of his games. He had 17 points at the half yesterday against Melbourne, which are the championship favorites. And he actually showed me some more things yesterday I didn't think he had in his game. He can actually handle the ball pretty well for a shooter, which was surprising. He put it behind the back twice in one possession and pulled up for a free throw line jumper in transition, which was pretty impressive to see. But he's got a wet ball. Like he's probably not ready to play big minutes in the NBA, but I would argue right now he could give him 6 or 7 spot minutes on that Warriors roster. You put him in the corner, nobody's leaving that kid open. No one's leaving to help. So it would create a bit more space for your Steph. But I like him. He's got a very wet ball, and it's not just feet set wide open threes. That's what I thought he was before I saw him play. I thought he's one of those, you know, feet set 3-point shooters, and he'll have to develop something a little bit different, like we spoke about before, maybe off the dribble, a little bit of a different aspect of his game. But I saw a few games where he was hitting some step backs, some long twos off a pull up, and I think he's got all the tools to be a very, very good shooter in the NBL and NBA. Sorry, and I think he will be there eventually. It's just a matter of when.
I mean, under certain circumstances, can the NBL be more difficult than the NBA, even if there's a talent gap, just because of how much time you have to strategize? You know, is that our theory, maybe beyond his own progression and improvement, for why LaMelo Ball, I mean, is suddenly playing better in theoretically, not theoretically, it is the best league in the world versus what he was doing in Australia?
Yeah, there's a lot of different dynamics. It is, we have 1 or 2 games a week, usually on weekends, so you got a lot of time to prepare. We have 4 or 5 full training sessions before we play. Scouting's pretty good, but also there's a lot of different defensive schemes. Like, it's kind of high school, AAU, college-ish. There's teams that pick up full court. There's teams that trap. There's teams that do all kinds of different things. So LaMelo probably would have saw all kinds of wacky shit, you know, and they go to zone, they trap, they don't. And I think that's what's going to be good for Jessup, is he's going to see a lot of different aspects of basketball. And I guess now you see LaMelo playing that free-flowing NBA style where you can't really touch anybody, everything's a foul. It suits him because he's been through the fire, and I think Jessup will go through a similar kind of anointment over here. And I'm a very pro sending kids over here rather than college or Europe. My argument is college, they're still home, everything's still pretty cruisy and easy, they're close to family. Europe's probably a bit too extreme with a language barrier. You don't know if you're going to get paid on time. You lose 3 straight games, you're not getting your paycheck. Australia, you know you're going to get paid. Not as much money. English-speaking country, you're still away from home. And there's many different styles of basketball from team to team within the league. So I think it's a great way to test kids' adversity, to see how they adapt to a different country, away from home, away from their friends and family. I'd much rather see draft picks, you know, come over here than go to the G League, in my opinion, because it'll show scouts and teams much more about a player rather than being in their home city playing for a G League team.
Yeah, well, LaMelo might pave the way. Okay, now for some quick hitter closing questions. Why do you think centers are coming back, man? It seemed like you guys were being marginalized and talked about as being dinosaurs, and then suddenly a lot of focus on centers in the bubble playoffs, and right now you've got Jokic and Embiid in the MVP hunt. What are the dynamics right now that is centering the center?
Your centers need multiple skill sets. You know, your Embiids and your Jokic's can all shoot the three ball, they can put it on the floor, they can post, they can play out of pick and roll. So you got to be multifaceted. I think the role-playing big man, like I was towards the end of my career, they're not big-minute guys anymore. They're probably 20 minutes max, DeAndre Jordan types, block shots, rebounds, set screens. But they are vitally needed for stretches of games, mainly for rim protection reasons. You see when there's not a traditional five-man that can protect the paint, you can see a big gap out there when those guys come out of games, because guys just get on the rim so much easier. It's very, very prevalent. But then on the flip side, you don't have the floor space as much as teams would like on the offensive end, because you've got a big now that can't stretch to the three-point line. So there's a bit of a balance there that teams are starting to figure out, but I still think there's a place for the traditional big man. It's just not at 40 minutes a game anymore.
Yeah, I think that's probably on point. Is Kevin Durant the greatest player you ever played with?
Wow. I think he's the greatest. Yeah, I would say he is. I'd have Steph up there as well. But KD's just the way he can score and all the different ways he can score. And let's be honest, he's 7 foot tall. He's long. He's athletic. He handles the ball like a point guard. All those skill sets with his – he'd be a guy, if you made a guy on NBA 2K, prototypical basketball player, I'd look like Kevin Durant. You know, long, athletic, wiry, strong, and handles the ball like a guard and shoots it. And just, he can just get you a bucket. You know, like the strange thing about like the Warriors, where we'd run out of motion and flow offense, was at the end of the day, you can just throw it to KD and get the fuck out of the way. just spread the floor, give him the ball anywhere on the floor, and he's a savant, man. Like he's up there as one of the most, you know, he'll be one of the best players to ever play the game. And I don't think he gets the credit, but doesn't at the same time, because of my argument of he's not, you know, as media savvy as LeBron and some of those guys.
Yeah, I mean, LeBron puts a lot of effort into it, or is fairly adroit at it. I mean, my theory is, beyond how good these guys are, I do think that players tend to respect size and height a little bit more. Maybe because you guys have to physically deal with it out there, versus if a guy like Steph is doing it to you, there's this idea that maybe I just won't fall for that particular move, right? And if it's Kevin Durant and he's that tall and it's just a fadeaway, it's like, what can you do about it? And so there's maybe a little bit of I don't know if it's preference or deference to that when the guy's big.
Yeah, there is, and KD's prototypical to that. Like, it's just, you can play a perfect defensive possession and there's nothing you knew about it. I had similar problems with Yao Ming back in the day. He got me for 36 one night and I did everything right defensively on the post-ups, everything right, and he just turned and shot fadeaways over me. It's like, what am I, my contest is about at his neck, face height. And you just got to chalk that one up to someone being a better player.
Did Yao Ming talk any shit?
Nah, he never really talks shit. He'd fire up a little bit and yell and scream when he gets an and one or something like that. But he was pretty chill with all that kind of stuff. He didn't really look for the confrontation. He was very, very talented for a guy 7'6" that could shoot the ball like that. He gave me fits a few games for sure.
Yeah, he was great back in the day. From the media perspective, for the closing questions, I'm curious, what have you talked about in the podcast that you didn't think necessarily would resonate with listeners that listeners really responded to?
Oh, wow. Honestly, my journey part of my podcast, I didn't think would do as well as it is. The numbers are really good on that, almost up there with the basketball, which is kind of surprising. I thought the basketball aspect would be kind of my bread and butter, just because I played basketball and I give some pretty controversial takes at times and just call it as I see it. But the My Journey stuff's actually been doing very, very well. I think just people understanding, kind of not knowing what my childhood was and what I've lived through and how I got to this point, you know. And it wasn't through, like I said earlier, it wasn't through being a golden child and making every team as a young guy and getting to the NBA. There was a lot of fire I had to get through. So probably the My Journey, just that whole series, has been very, very good and got a lot of good feedback from it.
Yeah. I mean, it's like you said before, it's new. It's not something we've really seen. This autobiographical podcast from an athlete. So it doesn't surprise me that people are really gravitating to it. I forgot to ask one Wiseman question. One of his issues has been hands, catching the ball. Is that something you think guys can improve? Are there drills that improve that? Or is that just, it is what it is. This is how good you are at it.
You can. There's different reasons why. Some guys sometimes get nervous before they're about to get a catch for a wide open dunk. Some guys just have bad hands. With him, I don't think he has bad hands. I think it's probably a little bit of a nerves thing at the moment. You can work on it. I think for me, having good hands was I played a lot of different ball sports. So not just basketball, but cricket, you know, which is equivalent to baseball over there. So handling like a little cricket ball, tennis, you know, so handling a lot of different ball sports, I think just gives you that hand-eye touch for your coordination that you kind of can transition a little bit into whatever sport you pick up. And a lot of guys I've found with hands that kind of bobble balls and whatnot, haven't played different sports as a young kid, and that you can definitely see that. But I don't think Wiseman's horrible by any means. He's just gonna, you know, just probably take his time, take a deep breath a little bit. There are little things you can do. There's these little they're kind of like the size of a tennis ball, but they've got different bounce points. So like, you know, just pointy, about 15 or 20 pointy ends on that ball. So for guys that had catching issues, I'd recommend for them to, just before the game, when you're doing your warm up, do 2 or 3 minutes of a coach throwing that ball at you, letting it bounce, and then you have to catch it. Just stuff like that, just to engage your hand eye coordination before the game can help a little bit. But yeah, it's something you probably got to do heavily in the off season if you want to improve that.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a big swing factor for him and his development. I guess the last question, pertinent to your emerging media empire, you broke this news about how the NBA was allowing every player to have up to 2 guests visit their room on the road, untested for COVID-19. And it didn't seem to resonate that much in media, which was curious. Although the NBA did change the policy, at least that's my memory of things. Were you surprised by that? How that all went? Because you're not used to breaking news. Now you broke news. You probably had a certain expectation of where this would all head and how it would all go. What did you think of how that was received and how that all progressed?
It was interesting. We're not really in the news breaking world for podcasts. Like I don't want to do that. I don't want to be getting, you know, I'm first to report this. It just came to me through somebody sent it and said, hey, you might find this interesting that they're wearing masks on the bench, they're social distancing, and they got all separate water coolers and blah, 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 blah. All the optics of it looked fantastic, but on the road they can, you know, have whoever they want to visit without being tested. So I thought it'd be pretty big news. I did catch the podcast. Who was it with that you were talking to about it?
Tom Haberstroh.
Yeah, good old Tommy boy said, because I basically prefaced it with, I don't know what I said, that the media's, you know, the toxic media, they're going to report this and cite me because I labeled it that way before I...
Oh, yeah. He floated. He was positing that the way you presented it, you negged us, and therefore we wouldn't want to do you a favor by making it a bigger story.
Maybe
it was an
right.
Interesting theory.
And maybe
I don't
right.
Necessarily buy it.
Yeah, it didn't get a lot of weren't a lot of citations, so I had my lawyer looking around who can send letters to, but nah, it's all good. Look, I mean, end of the day, a lot of people didn't want to cite it. It was on ESPN. There were a few that put the little watermark on the quote, but I'll give you another one. How about I break one on here? From what I've heard, okay. So this is another one. I'll break it on your podcast. This is the kind of stuff we'll do on Rogue Bogue, so everyone follow me on all those social media channels. Apparently, the referees can do whatever they want away from the court. How about that one? Is that a good one? Is that a good one for you? That's the news.
Yeah,
the news
I'm getting. What do you mean? What do you mean by whatever they want?
Well, there's no real protocols for them off the court. I mean, as far as besides testing, they can basically leave the hotel when they want. They can have visitors whenever they want. They can do whatever they want. So it's just, you know, it contradicts the messaging and the optics we get from the NBA that they're doing everything they can. Well, I don't know if that's because of the NBA referees union that they've said, you know, we're not doing that. They're going to have their everyday lives. They're not getting the money the NBA players are getting. Don't know what the fine details are, but from what I've heard, the referees can, they're up to their own devices and can be out in the community as per normal.
Refs party a little bit too. People don't know that.
Exactly right. You know? That's my point. So they can live their lives unobstructed. And that is an interesting one because they're touching the same ball as players. A lot of times players and referees get in each other's faces. So if we're really going all in with this, that might be a bit of an issue down the track.
Yeah. And, have you heard anything about refs being out and about or anything like that?
I have. But
I'm leading the witness.
Yeah, I have. But look, you have to, I don't know how many referees are in the league now. It's a couple hundred or whatever there is in the pool. You'd be an idiot to think that not one of them's been out. Look, I'm not saying they shouldn't. And if their unions push for them to be able to have their regular freedoms, great, fantastic for them. But then don't, you know, the optics of the rest of the stuff just kills me because a lot of it with this COVID stuff that leagues are doing, I know they have to try to do their best.
I get it. Like your main point isn't to condemn referees. It's to impugn the security theater.
Exactly.
And like, falseness come on, man. Of the
10 water coolers. Like you got 10 water coolers back there behind the bench. Like what difference does it make if I fill up a cup? Because they're all brand new cups every time you fill them up from one water cooler. It makes no difference. But optically, when I see it on TV, it's like, oh, look, they've got socially distanced water coolers. Fantastic. Like, come on, man.
Yeah. No, that is the thing where it's how much of the policy is informed by PR and backlash versus an actual attempt to curb infections. And if you're having players have multiple guests in the room untested all around the country, that seems to obviously be more of a generator of infections than a lot of the, you know, just the presentation and the masks on the bench and the coaches wearing masks, but players not wearing masks, which is also weird.
We use guests very loosely.
I use what very loosely?
Guests.
Guests. Oh, yeah. Guests in massive quotations. Yeah, I think just, we all know. Loosely,
yeah.
Well, you said something interesting about how players can't keep their own company, which was super interesting to me. I mean, if we're doing the personality types of the NBA, I think refs are pretty hard charging kind of partiers in some ways and, you know, hard living people on the road and players. Interestingly, just what do you think's behind that? Why is it so hard for guys to just be by themselves?
I don't know. It is an art form though to be by yourself. It's almost a skill. Like it's not easy to be in your room by yourself for 4, 5, 6, 7 straight hours. And one thing I just noticed throughout my journeys in the NBA was guys just can't sit in their room by themselves. A lot of us are action junkies. A lot of us want to be doing something. We're in New York. Well, I need to be out experiencing New York, or we're in Miami. I need to go to South Beach. I don't want to miss out FOMO, all that kind of stuff. But it was just an observation that I made, and it's not a knock, it's not a negative, it's not a positive, but I just noticed that players just could not sit in their rooms by themselves. And whenever I'd see a few guys that you'd hear, oh, I'm staying in tonight, I'm not going out. And then 2 hours later after sitting in their room, they're gone, you know, and it's just an interesting one. I'm not sure why exactly, but it was always an observation that I made. I got to a point where I had a routine, so I would get to the room, I would unwind a little bit off the flight or the bus, chill out for a bit, and then it'd get to 4 or 5 o'clock, I'd do some work on the computer, some emails, some business stuff, and then it'd get to dinner, and then if I wanted to stay in, I'd order room service and watch a movie and then be in bed. So I kind of had a routine, and I enjoyed my own company at times, and then every now and then, well, most road trips, I'd go out for dinner, so that'd be only from, 7 till 9, and then be back in the room and off to bed. I wasn't really a big partier throughout my career. I had a few moments where we'd, you know, the Scott Skiles era in Milwaukee, where he'd be absolutely frying our brains sometimes, where myself and Carlos Delfino would look at each other and said, hey, we need one of those nights, and we'd go and have one in New York or wherever we were that night. But other than that, I wasn't a big partier.
Yeah. I mean, my theory is that to be a professional athlete, you probably have a surplus of energy. And I remember first thinking about it when I was doing a story on Bazemore, and it was his free agency, and he was just, that guy has so much energy like roiling within him. And at that point he wasn't really getting to play, and that he had all the bench antics, I think, because of that. But I'm asking him what he does for fun, and he goes on 40-mile bike rides, and he is just watching the Tour de France, and he's pointing out, you know, which guy is going to tire out. And it's, oh, okay, I see that there's at least a cohort of guys in the NBA where maybe they got here because they just have more to burn, more capacity to burn than a lot of regular cubicle people have.
Oh, definitely. But if you're asking that question now, I think he's got some kids. You could probably get a different answer.
Yeah, he might have settled down a little bit. Well, Andrew, thanks. This was fantastic. Thanks for stopping by. Congratulations on your success, your emerging independent media empire. Is there anything you would like to promote specifically as we outro?
No, not really. Just the podcast at Rogue Bogues on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, all that fun stuff. We get the basketball podcast is weekly, if not bi-weekly. The My Journey ones pop up every now and then. And yeah, we want to interact with people listening as well. So we do Q&As with fans that can send in their questions through email, usually a week before we're recording. So we want our fans to be a part of it and ask questions that probably they don't get a chance to ask NBA players or former NBA players. So appreciate all the listeners. Appreciate you promoting it, and hopefully we can get up there with the Sherwood podcast.
The House of Strauss is the technical name, but someday, if only, you know, someday you guys will reach the commanding heights that I've ascended to, but not yet. Not yet. Thanks again. I want to thank the listeners. I want to thank Jade Hoy for doing fantastic super production. We will be back next week. Stay safe out there, everybody. See ya.